Welcome to the ID10T podcast. This episode of the ID10T podcast was brought to you by Squarespace. All right, Destiny is calling you. Are you prepared to answer the call? All right, it says you need a new website. You should make it with Squarespace. Just turn your idea into a website. Manifest it. Social media can be a pain in the ass, especially now. You need to have a web presence you can send people to, rather than trying to navigate all the other stuff that social media is forcing you to deal with, or not showing to your followers. How about that? Social media does that too. So if you have a website, you can sell services of all kind. You can blog or publish your content with no character limits, no random crazy people that you don't know just popping in and making horrible comments. You can own it fully. Own the experience fully. Beautiful templates on Squarespace, powerful e-commerce. You can customize the look and feel, settings, products, more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. And you can buy domains choosing from over 200 extensions and analytics that will help you grow in real time. Built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code ID10T, that's ID, the number 10, and T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast. And now, let us march over to the ID10T community corkboard. You know, a lot of people say, hey, you still doing corkboard? Now that's not Nerdist anymore. Yes, and that this is the proof that I'm doing that. You can send your corkboard items to corkboard@id10t.com. That's it. Just let us know. As long as you're not a massive company trying to take advantage of our corkboard, then we'll get to as many as we can for you, the community of listeners. Stephanie writes, I made a thing. Travel Craft Journal is my site for championing artists, makers, and explorers. During the month of February, I'm encouraging everyone to look for art where they live and share it using the hashtag LocalArtLoves. You can share art you love from galleries, comic book stores, coffee shops, murals, wherever you find it in your community. You can share your own work too, she says. And at the end of the month, I'll round up these local art finds on Travel Craft Journal so we can celebrate what artists are making in different parts of the world. More at travelcraftjournal.com/share or travelcraftjrnl on Twitter. Justin writes, I'm writing to plug my wife's candle project, Wicked Pop Candle Company. Nicely done. These are handmade pop culture-themed soy candles and wax melts with scents and labels, all created by my wonderful wife, Kristen. Each candle is a reference to something in pop culture, whether it be Rebel Scum or It's a Trap or You Will Be from her Star Wars line, the waffle-scented Eleven from Stranger Things, or I Suspect Nargles from Harry Potter. She sells her candles in local locations in Southwest Michigan at various artisan shows and online at Etsy.com/shop/WickedPopCandleCo. There you go. Also, I have stand-up shows at the Brea Improv and Levity Live in Oxnard, California, the next 2 weekends. So just Google that shit and find it, and then come see me. Wouldn't that be nice? It'd be nice to see you. April Richardson will be there. Mike Furman will be there. But let's talk about this podcast, episode 931. This is Danai Gurira, my friend, Walking Dead superstar, and now film superstar. All right. So The Walking Dead is back February 25th on AMC at 9 p.m., of course, followed by Talking Dead. And Black Panther is phenomenal. And she is phenomenal in it, like a legit movie star. She rules in this movie. And I am not just saying that because I get excited about lots of things and Danai is my friend. She is legitimately spectacular in this film. And also, she's a brilliant playwright. She's a wonderful, wonderful person, and I think you will enjoy this podcast with her. She's super fun and funny, and I, for every reason, really, really, really am inspired by and look up to Danai. So I'm so glad she took some time to come chat with me on the ID10T podcast while she was in town promoting Black Panther. This episode of the ID10T podcast, also sponsored by Squarespace. So postage rates have gone up again. So let stamps.com keep your rates down with postage discounts up to 40%. Discounts that you can't even get at the post office. Stamps.com saves you 3 cents on every letter you send. Pay 2016 prices for 2018 stamps. 3 cents might not sound like a lot, but if you're mailing a lot of stuff, it does add up. It really did. It will add up to dollars in no time, especially throughout the course of a year. So just use stamps.com to automatically calculate and print the correct amount of postage for every letter or package you send. Stamps.com makes it easy. They're going to send you a digital scale to automatically calculate exact postage, and they're going to help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do right now from your desk with stamps.com, except getting yelled at by strangers. I guess you can get that on the internet too. So if you still want that experience, just go to any chat thread or forum. Right now, you can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in ID10T. That is ID, the number 10, and T. You'll get used to it. That's Stamps.com. Enter ID10T. Thanks to Stamps for being a long-running sponsor of this podcast, which is episode 931. Denai Gurira, Katie Levine. Please roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
About LA history is kind of funny because it's like there's some stuff, you know, the way the city is now, there's some stuff in the late 1800s, but really most of the time, like 19 teens and 20s is the majority of what old is in this part of the country. So it's kind of a joke to the rest of the country and the world. We're like, this house is so old. It's like 1928.
That's still kind of old though.
Yeah, but you know, it's not.
I'm a New Yorker too, so I'm like, but I still think 1920s is an old ass building. Come on.
It is, but you know, you go to parts of New England where it's like, 1680. You're like, all right,
you win.
Can't compete with that.
What about these chairs?
They're all vintage chairs. They're all
so amazing.
They're all vintage chairs. Pretty much everything in the house is antique. And we can tell you.
Oh my God, you've got to have Nicotero over.
Well, that is a prop from 28 Days Later.
Oh wow.
Yeah, Lydia bought that prop from 28 Days Later.
Oh, she and Nicotero get along with it like a house on fire.
They know. They do text stuff that they get.
Oh, okay. They're connected.
Yeah, he has some Haunted Mansion wallpaper that we were trying to find, and so we were texting pictures back and forth.
You've got to see his house. Next time you're in Georgia, you've got to go see his Peachtree house.
I absolutely
will. He has the little exorcist girl, like...
Oh, yeah, we have one, too.
Oh, my God.
But I think he might have... Does he have a mold of the original one?
He might.
Ours was one that was made for Universal Studios, so it's not original, but it's terrifying.
Yeah, his is terrifying. You're like in his like big like screening room, and then you go up to the top of the stairs, and she's sitting there. It's like, oh my God, Nicotero.
Do you collect anything?
Oh, God, what an interesting question. I like little tiny clutch bags, you know, made of cloth and kind of cool print.
Nice.
That's really sad.
No, it's not. You know why? Because what's difficult is that when you are a nonstop working actor the way you are, where do you have time to like nest permanently in a place and really be able to fill it out with stuff?
I know. Well, I've spent the last couple days with my organizer. I haven't been in my LA place for so long, so I've just been in Atlanta flat out. So I just spent 2 days with her just trying to, and people crash in my apartment a lot. They're like, oh, Denai, are you there? Can I crash for a month? You know, so people are in my apartment a lot that are not me. And I went there, I was like, okay, I don't even know whose apartment this is. Like, I don't recognize, like, I guess these are clothes I used to wear. I guess this is, you know what I mean? Like, I had to just
purge
and cleanse and get so many things reorganized, and so that's what I've been doing for the last few days, and we've got buckets of like just stuff that's going to Goodwill, and you know.
Do you have a process for getting rid of stuff?
Well, you know, because my organizer's great because she kind of taught me how to do it. So I can do a lot of it by myself now. Like, I can just look at my wardrobe and I'm like, I don't like that I'm looking at clothes I never wear. I don't like that.
Right.
They are not meant to be mine anymore.
You've
and I just go, rah, 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 like Tasmanian devil. Now, I used to not do that. I used to be very like, you know, God bless her, but like my mom, where it's like, you know, you hold on to things and you're a little bit of a hoarder. You hold on. I'm like, it feels so good to let go of stuff.
It is amazing how much you will tell yourself, well, someday I might, like, no matter how weird the thing is,
yeah,
someday I might need these, you know, pool flippers. Like, if you haven't used them in 5 years, it is unlikely that you will be in a situation where someone goes, quick, I need pool flippers.
I know. And that's why you need an organizer, because she is that other pair of eyes and ears, and she's looking at you like, it's kind of nasty. It's like, it's covered in stuff now.
Well, that's
it's
what
got stains on it.
The problem is emotion. Like, when you put emotion into stuff, when you put too much emotion into stuff, and an organizer has no emotion about any of your things.
Exactly.
So they can go,
exactly.
Empirically, do you use this? No, you don't need to have this anymore.
Exactly. When was the last time you touched this thing?
Well, but I look at it. Yeah, I know it's there. I like knowing it's there.
No,
I like
you don't
knowing
need
all
it.
My
you
stuff
can get something
there.
Else. Like, it's like, she's great. Like, then you're just like, okay. So now I sort of have her in my system. You start to get it, like, it becomes a little infectious. Thank
right.
goodness. And so I can sort of do quite a bit by myself. But she came in and we got really into it.
This is good. And we've been recording, by the way, just so you know. We already started.
All right, I figured.
Yeah. Because it just feels weird to go, it is now time to start the conversation.
I know.
And then someone goes, oh, I better, you know,
put myself together.
I better put myself together emotionally so I can present
together.
Myself
so this is great.
In
like,
a way.
I'll just keep going.
I had so much fun.
I know,
with you
that was so
and
fun.
Coleman.
Did we get that? Did that video come out of you getting caught by the, you know, the gods of dance?
Yes.
Oh,
it went up.
Awesome.
It went up.
That was hilarious.
I was overtaken by the power of Boz Skaggs.
Oh my
Skaggs.
God, possessed. Just, he became possessed. It was really cool.
That was Yacht Rock. You know, AMC, they did the party the night before, they had the B-52s,
mm-hmm.
and then they had a Yacht Rock band the next night, and
mm-hmm.
both experiences were fantastic.
They were. They were really good picks. And there were songs I didn't even know I knew. From the B-52s. Like, I didn't know that I knew those songs, but I know those songs well.
Fred Schneider still got it, by the way.
They were amazing.
Goes a narwhal. Like, he still can do the Fred Schneider voice.
He was awesome. I mean, they were all awesome. Because I was like, I watched them. I said, I think they're exactly who I want to be when I grow up. And I was like, I think I want to hang out with these guys. Because, I mean, they just have this, like, they're just having so much fun.
Yeah.
They're still so in it. They're like, they have their own energy. Each one of them had a very distinct energy,
yes.
by the way.
Yes, they
and
do.
And it's like, they're still doing their thing. You know, it was really kind of inspiring to watch them jam out.
Yeah, it's Fred Schneider and Cindy Wilson and Kate Pearson and... You know, they were just like a punk band, you know,
yeah.
Athens,
yeah.
Georgia. And,
oh, is that where they're from?
They're from Athens, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And, started in the 70s, and then the 80s had a super kind of punk alternative, almost surf rock kind of vibe. And then in the 90s, they came out with, you know, this album, Cosmic Thing, which, you know, like, that was the huge, like, those are all the songs that
all
everyone...
Right. Oh, that was in the 90s.
That was in the 90s. That was the late 80s, early 90s. Might have been late 80s, but 90s... The early 90s is when it all really, like, exploded for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always fascinated by that story of you never know where your career is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
You, as long as you're willing to adapt and do things that are exciting and try things, you know, like, they just went from this punk band to, you know, hopefully being set for life to be able to keep doing whatever they want.
Well, their songs are still very, very well known and out there. I've heard their songs a lot, so that's really cool.
But the older songs are weird because they're not so... You know, like the newer, the 90s ones were more hook driven,
mm-hmm.
and the older ones are so.
They're kind of performance piecey.
Performance pieces, that's
yeah.
exactly right.
Which I loved. I was like, this is cool. This is like Rocky Horror Picture Show type
that's
stuff.
That's exactly right.
It was like, it's interesting. That's when, you know, artists are having a real good blast. You know, they're not trying to please nobody.
Were you
it's
ever
cool.
in a band?
Huh?
Were you ever in a band?
No.
No?
Actually,
ah.
I was in this little a cappella group when I was in high school, and we'd sing at like different little events and things. Not really, where were we singing? We'd sing at like school events. Like Zimbabwe is very like single sex schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to an all girls school, but then there were two all boys schools that we were really close to and we interacted with a lot. And so it was us. Oh no, actually he was from the other all boys school, but he was a brother of one of the girls from my school. So there was just a little group of us and we created this little, you know, we'd be singing covers, obviously,
mm-hmm.
of like, you know, Boys to Men and whatnot, and we'd harmonize and, you know, yeah.
Did your group have a name?
No, I don't think so. I think we just went around and sang at different places, like little events and stuff. I was actually the weakest link by far. And this one time, I actually nailed it and did a good job. And then one of them came up to me. And they were always really nice. They never said anything to me about it. And then one of them came up to me and they said, "Oh my God, Danai, you actually did it today. You got the notes. You did it." And I was like, "Really?" So all this time, I just been messing up. Y'all didn't say nothing. Wow.
The more I get to know you, the more I think, the more I, because I just have this picture of you of like, oh, Danai can do anything. Danai can do any artistic thing. She can write. She can act. She can direct. She can sing. She can. But when we're not dancing the night, you go, "I don't have any moves." And I'm like, "That's not true. I don't have any moves."
You have some moves. We have some evidence
of
your moves.
I have comedy moves.
You had some moves. That was a move.
I have. It's a comedy move, though.
That was a move. I mean, like, I can dance if it hits me right. You know what I mean? Like, I can't, like, when I was hanging out with, like, the folks from Black Panther, we'd go dancing and stuff, I'd be like, Okay. All right, I'm getting there. Like, I got to warm up into it. And I'm around these amazing dancers. And, you know, the ladies who are like our my Dormilaje army, are half of them are dancers.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And the other half are just, you know, rhythmically blessed or whatever. And, like, you know, Lupita's an astounding dancer. And we're all like, so I'm sort of getting there. I'm sort of like, okay, I'm catching it. Caught it! Then I have it for maybe 20 minutes and then it slips away. And then I get it back. You know, it's an ebb and a flow.
God, I want to stay, and I left for the saddest reason, which is, you know, I started getting like tinnitus last year, like going to loud things, my ears would ring for weeks at a time.
Oh,
and
that's bad.
And it's not fun.
No.
At a certain point, and I was like, shit, I should have brought earplugs like an old person.
It's real. I've had the ear ringing thing too, not for weeks. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But I've had that, and it's no joke. So yeah, no, we understood.
Okay, good.
We did understand. Coleman, we were sad to see you go.
Coleman Domingo also was.
Coleman Domingo.
Roman Domingo.
You got it now. That's good.
Well, we played in the car from the musical that
I did. Passing Strange. Stu. Oh my God. You can't do anything but just repeat and imitate that man. He's so good.
Coleman's another like super talented guy.
Oh,
like,
God, oh, yeah.
You know, and he's acts.
And he does sing.
He writes
and he acts.
And he sings and he dances.
Yes, and he dances.
And he's also just so lovely. He and Raul are just
awesome.
the loveliest people. And they came
awesome.
Away with us on vacation last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very nice.
We had a group of people come and we had been...
Where'd you go?
My wife's family has a ranch that we went to, and we just took them there, and they were
cool.
Great. It was, they're just so sweet, and
they are.
And it's a larger thing about, I don't know what it is about the Walking Dead universe in particular, but everyone's really nice. Like it's just like a nice group. It feels like, I mean, you know, I'm not there.
Isn't that like it is everywhere? I mean, I can't imagine it's different in other places.
I think it is different in other places.
Really?
I do, but maybe it's. Maybe some of it is also, besides the fact that everyone just seems pretty cool, I would imagine when you're, because now Atlanta is becoming like a real,
yes,
you know,
a
real entertainment hub. But when Walking Dead started, it was just kind of creeping in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it just, I imagine it's like you're out in the middle of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
You're all there together.
Mm-hmm.
You probably want to figure out how to all, you know, like, hang out and be friends because
mm-hmm.
you're isolated from the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, I wasn't there at the very beginning, but I think it was this beautiful thing about these really fantastic actors that were picked in the beginning. And I think they set a very particular foundation. The sort of, and I watched it when I finally had to watch it when I was auditioning for it because I'm scared of stuff. So when I watched it, I just felt that I felt a very particular energy. I felt the spirit of the thing, as my clown teacher would say.
Yeah.
And it was just the spirit of the thing was, it was just right. They were there for the work and
mm-hmm.
they were giving their all to the work, kind of like great. You know, like great theater does.
Yes.
You feel that thing. And then you want to be like, I was like, I want to be a part of that. Like, but like, it wasn't surprising to me that they were all amazing people and that it was like really nice, grounded people because you can sort of feel it.
Yes.
By how they approached the work. It was so committed and generous and, and just alive in a way that, just felt like it was coming from a humble place.
Yeah.
And I think that and then of course having Andy Lincoln be who he is kind of like kind of the kindest hearted person I have ever come across in my life. I think that, and the most, you know, grounded at the same time. I think, of course, you know, he's the leading man. And I just think that I do think we have the best leading man on television.
It's pretty great. But that season two finale, the Michonne reveal with the pets and the shadow, like, you know, where Andrea's down on the ground and then Michonne, because obviously I read the comics, and that was I legitimately jumped off the couch. I was like, holy shit! You know, because...
Well, so did I, because that wasn't me.
That wasn't you. I don't think I knew that.
No, you know, I got cast after that. And, you know, oh, no, well, actually, I got cast after they shot that, but before they aired it.
Got it.
So what they did was the weekend they had to cast a Michonne the weekend that aired because she was introduced.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they would have shot that in November, but it aired in like March, April.
Yeah.
And so it was, I think it was on your show where basically Kirkman and the then showrunner Glenn Mazzara were like, and our Michonne is.
Yes.
And they were there with Laurie Holden. And that was kind of when I was introduced, but I had only been cast on Friday night. That was Sunday.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but so that was a stunt double. That's why you didn't see her. Big reason why you didn't see her face.
Well, it never occurred to me. I just thought it was for dramatic effect, and it totally
it worked. It was so smart. And what Glenn literally said to me was, "You'll see the strange way that we will introduce you on Sunday. Watch the show." That's what I'm saying. I learned how I was introduced with you.
That's hilarious.
I learned who I was with you.
And then, of course, because even back then, even though that was like 5 years ago now, but almost 6 years ago.
Yeah, six, yeah.
But just the idea, was it weird when you heard about what Talking Dead was, where you're like, well, that's weird. Why would someone talk about it? What the fuck is that?
Yeah, I was like, what is this? Is this something we have to take seriously? But I don't know who told me this, but they were like, get everything. Like, if you have any sort of online presence, like, let's say, a Match profile eHarmony, get rid of it before Friday night. I was like, why? I only started shooting in April. Not that I had anything.
Right.
But I was like, I only started shooting in April. And they're like, well, Talking Dead. I was like, Talking Dead?
Why would someone do that? What a silly idea.
No, at first I was like, what is that? And then I got to understand. I mean, one episode, and I watched, of course, that episode. And I was like, oh, okay. I get what it is. I get it.
Yeah, you just go on a talk. And that's it. That's pretty much.
Yeah, it made perfect sense.
But there's so much, you know, and when I emailed you to ask you to come on the podcast, I was so excited to have to, because as a creator, you do so many different types of things. And they're all very big things to manage between, you know, Walking Dead and Black Panther, but also being a playwright and writing this Tony Award-winning play that Lupita was in. I mean, I'm interested to kind of find out how your brain compartmentalizes and where you how you're sort of diverting your creative energy, because all of those things require an immense amount of focus and creative energy.
I think it's something I'm still figuring out, but I guess it's like, oh God, you tell me, you do about 4,000 things yourself.
I do, but when I hear like playwright, I go, oh fuck, that's a big one.
It's hard. Sometimes I actually, like right now they're rehearsing one of my plays in DC, and I will be anywhere. I'll be chilling with you without in Sundance. I'll be wherever, and I'm going, okay, so in that scene, I really think you should think about, and I'm texting the director, like let go, deny. Yeah, it is, because it's like they're really like your children. So it's, and you spend a long time creating them, so it's hard to just let them go.
I mean, I have a series of part-time jobs that all come together to form a full-time job, but a show like The Walking Dead and that single camera schedule where it's like, well, one day you could shoot from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. or 9 p.m. to, you know, 11 a.m. You just don't know what your schedule is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's especially a show like this, which is not light fare. Mm-hmm. You're almost constantly emotional, almost constantly swinging a katana, running around.
Mm-hmm.
That drain, it just feels like, how do you have any energy left to do anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think the drive in it all is sometimes like I have to, like, you just, you know, you're just like, I have to get that done. Like, I have to complete that thing. Like, for me, it's like I cannot have started something and not finish it.
Yes.
And if it's something that, like with plays, if they just, my play ideas, they just sit on me like a weight. And they're like, hello, get me done. And then I'm stupid enough to get theaters involved. So then they're like, hello. And so that's great, actually, because then you're being pushed to the finish line.
Yes.
And then you have, you know, they want to cast and they want, you know, they want to put it in the seat. They read a first draft. They're like, let's develop this. Let's get it going. Let's do this. When are you free? And so all of a sudden, you're just, it's like you're on a train of collaboration.
Yes.
And that that's a big part of it as well. But it's also because, I don't know, like my last play was probably the hardest one I've ever written. And it was basically inspired by my family, ironically. And it was very difficult to write. I think it was because I had so much story and I had to find a way to make it muscular.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very difficult. Like, it took me a couple years and like one production in, by this end of the, by the day before the press came out, the second production, I think I'd be found what I called It's David, which is sort of like, it's this thing that was said actually by this very cool pastor, which is kind of like, you know, with Michelangelo, he had this huge, you know, piece of marble.
Yeah, and he saw the David inside.
Yeah, but and then they said, how did you get to the David? How did you make that? And he was like, I just chipped away everything that wasn't the David.
Oh my gosh.
And so like that was kind of my whole thing that was driving me to get to the, to getting my play to the place where all the stuff that wasn't it was chipped away. And the problem with plays is that they start to consume you,
yeah,
and take over you and say, I am the telling you what the story is now,
mm-hmm,
and you have to invest in me deeply enough for you to hear what it is.
Right.
So it's that was a real mother of a journey because it was like, well, this is about family. I know this story so well. I know so many of these stories so well. How can I? But it was like so interesting that that was kind of the trickiest birth.
Well, yeah, because it's really hard when you're really close to stuff because yeah, it starts to, when you're super close to stuff, you kind of don't know, like, well, am I too emotional about this? Are people going to understand this? How am I? Is this the right? Do I have the right perspective on this? Because you
right,
almost don't have that third person perspective on stuff that's that close to your.
Oh yeah,
art.
And that's when the collaborators, that's when they all come in and they let you know.
It's like the organizers, like the closet organizers.
Right.
They
exactly
have to help you chip away.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're like, meh, meh. But
yeah,
then the greatest thing, one of the greatest things the directors ever said to me was Emily Mann. She's also a playwright. That's really helpful that she's a playwright and a director, and she's the head of McCarter Theater. And with my third play, The Convert, she said to me, because I was sort of flailing in a lot of too much collaboration, which
oh,
can
gotcha,
happen. Can happen when you're getting too many voices, too mm-hmm, many opinions in the room. And she said the best thing to me ever. She said, only it wasn't, she loved it, but it wasn't there. It wasn't where it needed to be. The David had not been shipped out. You know,
it was just kind of a Dave.
Exactly. Exactly. It was still Dave.
Hey.
You know, he had a bit of a pot belly.
Yeah,
you know?
A little pot belly. Yeah, it's like
love handles. You know, he needed
towel around his
exactly,
waist.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, dripping wet.
Stupid. And so she said to me, she just said to me, only you know how this play works. And sometimes that's just such a simple thing to hear, but it's that reminder that you have to birth this thing. And I think when I realized that, like when I heard that, I cut everybody out,
mm-hmm,
and then I cut out the time. And that's the thing, I guess, to answer your question, is like cutting out the time to be like, I've heard everybody's thoughts, and now I have to figure out how this engine works, you know, and how to get it to the place where it is its own David, whatever that is.
Right.
And so that's when you just get driven. Like I remember like, writing it was a very controversial monologue. It was like, but suddenly I was finding like the lexicon of this world and I was hearing it, you know, it sounds spooky, but it's real. Like you start to hear the characters, you stop forcing them to speak. They start to speak. And then you sort of start. And I was like, it was like 3 a.m. and suddenly I had this gush, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So once that sort of starts taking over, it kind of insists on you making room for it.
Right.
You know, and it's become harder and harder to write. I won't lie, as things have gotten more intense with other parts of my life.
Right.
And so it is about like creating what some would call a rule of life. Like, where do you make sure it fits? Like, right. Where do you make sure? And the great thing is I have a very vibrant and insistent theater community that are like, so you wanted to do a reading of that play because you're thinking about adapting it. So we're thinking mid-February, you know, like, and they're on you. And it's great because then it's like, this keeps that engine going and you make space for it.
Sure.
You know, it's a community. It takes a village, basically. Basically, it takes a village. There's a great women's retreat off the coast of Seattle called Hedgebrook. It's for women writers, and it's got these cute little like Hansel and Gretel looking like cottages, and mm-hmm. everyone has their own cottage, and then they go into the main house for dinner together, and they have little baskets, and they have all this organic food from the organic garden, and you put your little lunch in your basket, and you go over to your cottage and write. And so they've invited me to come back there for March, and I know I'll get a ton done. But they, you know, that's when your village comes to you and reminds you, you know. And some of them are really unimpressed about my acting. They're just like, they're like, you're a playwright. You're a playwright. So when are you going to be done with the zombie thing?
Yeah.
And come and be a playwright all the time.
It's fun to play dress up, but when
exactly?
Are you,
like, what are you doing?
I know the wig and the sword. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. She will remain nameless, but with a very head of a big theater. She's like, well, so what is this you're doing? You're still doing that? So when are you going to get this? But you're a writer, Danai. You're a playwright. You know, like, they remind you of
it's
who
pretty,
you are.
I mean, playwright's pretty highbrow. It is pretty highbrow. But, you know, also because you... You know, where if you're in a movie or a television show, it's like, oh, you know, they know what they want, but they shoot a bunch of stuff, whatever works, they don't cut it out. But with a play, it really, with any kind of live performance, it really is kind of a conversation with the audience. You have mm-hmm. this idea in your head, I imagine, that you go, I think this is how this works. Mm-hmm. And you put it in front of people and you go, ah, the audience doesn't necessarily think that's how mm-hmm. it works. So do you listen to the audience and form a relationship with them and edit appropriately? Or do you go, no, this is what it is, you know, don't
No,
like
no,
it.
I'm always willing to edit appropriately. But, I mean, the great thing about with theater is that you don't have, you don't get in front of an audience for a long time. Your audience are people that are pretty safe and aren't going to write a review,
right.
you know, for a long time. You're watching it in front of you know, you're watching other people listen to it around a table in development processes. Like with my last play, I did like 5-6 workshops of it, you know, at least.
Wow.
And then, you know, and then of course there's the rehearsal process, and so that's where also you hear a lot and think a lot. But what's funny is that last play, yeah, I you do kind of sit and watch it on first previews, because you have about, depending on the theater, you can have 10 to 20 previews where I can still be tweaking a script,
yeah,
and having audiences at night, and the previews only stop once, of course, the press comes. And so I, you know, you can sit and sort of watch and see how people are going to respond to it, and then, you know, or how they're responding to something. If something isn't making sense, you're like, does that make sense? Let me go think about that, and let me think if I can clear it up or bounce it off somebody. And, you know, my last play was like right up until the last preview. This woman I really love, she's the associate head of the Public Theater in New York, Mandy Hackett, and she came, and I was like, okay, break it down, because she's amazing. And she was like, this was a bit of a red herring, and this was blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you're so right. And I get on the phone and I'm like, guys, we need that rehearsal. We had 2 hours left of rehearsal.
Oh my God.
Before they were like, no more rehearsals, now the play's open. And I was like, I need those 2 hours. I know we said we didn't need the 2 hours. I need the 2 hours. And my director's like, well, I was like, no, we need the 2 hours. I need to put these things in. And it was like, you know, so it was right to the end. If I hear a good note, I'm not going to ignore it. I'm not one of those folks. I totally, and I do that with my acting too. If I get a good note on acting and a great idea, I'm like, oh my God, thank you. And I'll do it. Like, I mean, or I'll go into finding that, you know what I mean? So no, I'm not one of those.
Could you ever be in one of your plays?
You know, my first play was a two-hander that I co-created in grad school. And then it sort of rolled into this sort of off-Broadway hit. But I don't want to do that. it became this thing where my co-creator was Nicole Salter. She was someone I was in grad school with and in my class. And so we basically we became the face and the writers of this show. Mm-hmm. And so we were off Broadway for a long time. Then all these theaters had like slotted us into their year or so, or the seasons. We were all over there. Then we were in Europe, and then we were in Africa, and then we were back in the States for more. And then we were back in Africa. Then they wanted us back to do another. And we were like, nah. You said, okay, no, thanks. We wrote this actually for other black girls to have something to pick up and do, and we don't want to be the only ones doing it.
Right.
So let some other girls do it, you know? It was about, like, the issue of two women in totally different places, one here in Los Angeles where she's from, and one in Zimbabwe where I'm from. The weekend, like, my character was, like, married with a kid and a newscaster. Her character was kind of a tricky teen. Mm-hmm. And they both find out, they never meet, but they both find out they have HIV, and then they have to navigate the weekend of just before diagnosis to just before the first attempt to disclose. So we sort of take the audience through that by playing a bunch of characters. So yeah, we kind of got branded a bit for doing that because it was a very, you know, it was a very particular type of performance piece, which was full of kind of laughter and tears and everything, you mm-hmm. know. And so, you know, it sort of became this thing where they thought, no, these two women are the only two who can do these roles. I was doing a bunch of characters out of Zimbabwe. She was doing a bunch of characters out of L.A. And it was like, no, please, we're done. Take it. Let other people do it.
Yeah.
And so that's the only time. And after that, I said, I want to be the sort of playwright who sits and watches and makes sure it's all good, sees opening night, feels good, and leaves.
And goes and writes another play.
Right, or whatever, yeah. You know, and then knows that, oh, it's going on every night. I don't have to be there, but it's going on. But I did all the blood, sweat, and tears, and now I let people enjoy performing it.
Is any part of what you're writing, do you feel a responsibility to create the types of roles that you don't see?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I started writing. It really was necessity being the mother of invention. Like, I was a black girl from Zimbabwe, and you know, I was looking for monologues and things like that. My first play is all monologue. In the Continuum is these two characters talking to people that you can't see. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's not like soliloquy monologue. You know, I'm not Shakespeare, but it's like the sort of, you know, monologues where it's like kind of mono dialogue.
Sure.
And you know, the one of the coolest things I've experienced was when the first time a girl came up to me and said I used a monologue from In the Continuum to get into Juilliard.
Oh my God!
And I'm like, that was the point. Like, that was the point. Holy. Because I couldn't find things to get up and perform that connected to anything culturally specific to me. And it was very hard to find that. And so it was like, I know this is not just hard for me. I know it's hard for a lot of girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as I adore Shakespeare and Moliere and, you know, Chekhov and, you know, all of, you know, the amazing Shaw. I love those, you know, I love those dead white dudes. I adore them. I really do, though. But, like, you know, and even the modern guys. But it's that thing where you're trying to, it's like, I want girls to be able to pick up stuff that they like, okay, this feels close to me.
Right.
You know, and that was really why I started writing.
And was it kind of fun to, I guess technically with Lupita, like, you're sort of her employer in one sense, but then you're co-stars in Black Panther at the same time. Like, are you?
I'm not her employer. Ain't nobody employ Lupita but Lupita, okay? What are you talking about?
You wrote a play, the play that she was in that you wrote, which got nominated for 2 Tonys.
Six, but yeah.
Six?
It's okay.
You won. I know you won one.
No, yes, our amazing costume designer, he won. And then there were 3 acting nominations, director and best play.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, no, I mean, yeah, that was a serious blessing.
Were you friends before?
We were. She was she had been at Yale when it was first done at Yale in 2009. Yale has this thing where their MFA students understudy the plays in the big production house.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had understudied the role she ended up playing 6 years later on Broadway.
Wow.
I know. And she just loved the play. We all became buddies from then. And I'd known her. I'd met her briefly before. And it was very funny because I went to Tisch. I'm a Tisch girl, but I've done, like, almost all my plays have been produced at Yale. So I spent a lot of time at Yale and I was commissioned by them, et cetera.
Highbrow.
So,
Going back to highbrow.
People think I went to Yale. I'm like, no, I went to Tisch. They're like, oh. Excuse me, Tisch is an amazing. In fact, they're very close. They're competitive with each other, and so, you know, Tisch. The thing is, Tisch lost its master acting teacher Ron Van Loo to Yale. So they came and took him and dangled something before
Yale.
Him. And so she was then just about to go into grad school, and she auditioned, and they all were like, this chick is luminous. So they were fighting for her like the girl is mine. So then basically they, do you know the exact image I'm talking about?
I pictured the Paul McCartney, Stevie Wonder
exactly.
song.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A not yeah. Stevie Wonder. It's Michael Jackson.
Oh, Michael Jackson. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, no. I was thinking of Ebony and Ivory.
When they're both pulling.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
The doggone girly.
Exactly.
Who said doggone was a good word for a song?
About
it's,
a girl.
It's not a great. Yeah, exactly.
The
exactly.
Doggone girl.
By the way, no one seems to be considering what the girl wants in this song.
I know. Even in the little picture of them fighting for her, it's like they're both holding her arms. Yeah. It's like, does she have a say in this? Just asking. So funny. So yeah, that's kind of what was going on. And they called in all the Tish was going hard. They called in all the African alums and they said, talk to her. And so I remember talking to her and I said, what do you want? And she was like, well, I want to do stuff like you do and do this and this and this. I was like, then go to Tish. Tish will do that. I was like, what am I doing? I'm like this Tish advert, you know, it was so hilarious.
But she ended up going to you.
She didn't listen to me.
She didn't listen to you at all. But you know, it seems like things worked out just fine.
I think things worked out okay. I think she can just get by. She's done all right.
I really think she's going to have a future.
I think she'll be all right. She might be fine.
Feels like she's going to be okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, coming from a theater background, and then even though you said, like, the playwright community is like, you're a playwright, this is a theater. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, you know, Walking Dead, Black Panther, superhero genre, this horror genre, it is very theatrical in a sense. Like,
that's true.
It does seem like it's...
That's true.
Even though the mediums are different, mm-hmm. it does sort of feel like there's a certain spiritual aspect that's very, you know, very mm-hmm. of that kind of theater world.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And it's been great because, I mean, I've been able to... The people I've worked around have really amazing storytelling, you know, abilities and focuses. They're not... trying to make something just like skimming by. They're trying to go in. They're trying to go deep. They're trying to tell a serious, like deep, real story, the sort of story that lasts and stays and, you know, resonates and all of that. And that's what I've been able to experience with like Ryan and with, you know, Gimple. You know, they really are anchoring real storytelling in a really powerful way. So, and it's true. I mean, there is something, you know, that epicness of those types of genres. There is something, you know, you have to... There is something theatrical about it. I've never even thought about that, but that's, you're right.
Because you also have to take this thing that it where it's like whether it's zombies or whether it's you know you're in you know these insane costumes and you still have to somehow ground that and sell it to an audience and go, I know everything around me looks very far-fetched.
Right.
But there's still a nugget of humanity and there's still truth in here.
Yeah,
that's what I have to convey.
Yeah. You have to. And that's what I loved when I watched, you know, when I watched The Walking Dead. And when I've watched Marvel movies. Like, there's something so grounded in something very real and rich. And then it's surrounded by these epic components. You know what I mean? And that's where you have to start. Like, that's totally where you have to start, is the truth of the thing. You know, finding the truth of the thing. Because otherwise, what are you doing? You know?
What do you do if you can't... If you keep banging your head against the wall, like, oh, it's there, but I'm not seeing it yet.
In what context?
In any context. Like, if it's writing, or if it's acting, or if you're in a... You know, if there's a scene, or there's something, and you just can't... get to, you know, it's like I have an idea of what this is, but I still don't know what the ultimate truth of this thing is. So how do I get the message across?
Well, two things. If you don't know have the idea of the ultimate truth, I tend to go to the writer, because I'm kind of those people who, like, I believe whatever needs to be known is in the hands of the writer, mm-hmm. because they're birthing the narrative.
Sure.
And so, because I think that that's where everyone should come when they're trying to figure out my plays, come to me. What are you doing?
Well, I see where this is going.
But that's what I tend to do. So, like, I will go and spend a lot of time with the writer. I'll spend a lot of time. I'm like, you know, I'll text Gimple. I'm like, I'm not sure what this is. Help me out. And he always does. Like, then I'm like,
right.
Or, you know, of course, working very collaboratively with Ryan over Black Panther, you know, very deeply collaborating and understanding what the story was and what we were getting at. So, like, that's one of the key things that I have to do. I have to spend time understanding the intent. Then, if I still need to get there, I mean, there are a few ways. But one of them, you know, before it gets a little desperate, because it can get desperate, very. But one of the ways is finding your as if, they say in acting. So what is that thing that the stake is that high for your character? What would be the equivalent of that for you? Or for something that you feel really resonates for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is. And that's what you got to use, whatever you got to use. But you're trying to allow your character to have, you're trying to connect to the emotional life your character's experiencing.
Yeah.
At the stakes that they're experiencing it. So whatever it takes to get to that place
yeah.
is what you employ. It might be stuff later. You're like, dang, did I really imagine that happening to so-and-so? You know, whatever. But sure. it's like you have to go for the character. It's like it doesn't matter.
Well, early on in Walking Dead, I remember I said something to you about like Michonne's very even and she seems to come from this one place. And you're like, oh, she's emotional. There's just stuff that's just not like you seem. You're like, no, but she just and then she very much evolved. Like you started to see all the stuff that you were talking about early on. But it seemed like in the beginning you wanted to get there faster than the show wanted her to get there.
Of course I did. I was like, why doesn't she talk? I'm a talker and I talk good. Me talk pretty. So why can't she talk too? You know. So you know. But it was what was cool was when I did start with her voice was so different from mine when I really would click into her, I'm like, man, she doesn't have it. And her voice started to open up, but in the beginning it was kind of this lower, raspier thing, and I'm like, who is that? Like, she was just a different chick from me.
Yeah.
And like, my sister was like, this one moment you had in the, talking about the whole of season three, it's like, there's this one moment where I saw you, like, there's this one tiny moment, and I was like, that's, well, good then.
Right.
F it. Like, if my own sister doesn't see me for an entire season, and she sees this other chick, that's good. Yeah. I mean, because I was working against how Danai would want to express things.
Right.
I'm like, I'd be like, okay, y'all. So there's this dude calls himself governor and he's on the road. You know what I mean? Like I would have and she doesn't do that. She wouldn't do that. You know, she was very guarded.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting to find that. It was frustrating because some people, not you, but some people saw her nuances early, but others. But like it was like there was that some people said to me, you can see these moments where she's cracking and then she's pulling it back. And that's kind of what was happening. There were times where, yeah, I would do takes where I would crack all the way and then they wouldn't use that.
Right.
And it was like I could sort of see what they were doing. They were preserving that for a different time period.
Right.
When she would like open up.
Right.
And it wasn't the time. But for me, how I wanted to see her go, I was like, she can crack right here real good. But like, you know, that was good. I mean, it was good ultimately for her arc that she was that guarded and cut off. And, you know, there was a lot of rage going on inside her. And the rage was just from hurt.
Sure.
But, you know, and that caused her to be someone who was really, and it's also from fear. I don't want to open up. I open up and I'm stuck with that for the rest of, you know, dealing with the pieces. So, you know, she was cut off for a reason. And so, but that was frustrating. It was frustrating, but it was right. It was very right for her.
And I also want to say that being in the, moderating the Black Panther panel at Comic-Con was... What, you know, I have a handful of, they're all, like, all of Comic-Con is always fun for me, but there's a handful of, like, of those really standout moments where I go, ah, and I was there when this happened. Like, when they, you know, when they announced Batman versus Superman, people shit their pants. When they announced, you know, Deadpool, people lost their fucking minds. And Black Panther, when the footage played, was one of the craziest I've ever seen Hall H get. To the extent where, because what I didn't know is, I don't think any of you had seen the footage.
No,
and I thought Chadwick had said, like, we hadn't seen this yet.
Yeah.
And so when you guys watched it, and it's like the chairs got knocked over, and you guys were flipping out, and Hall H absorbed that energy, and just how fantastic the movie looked. Because that's always the moment for the audience, too, is like, they want to like, you know, like, I mean, like, they want to like stuff. You know, not everything's going to knock it out of the park. So there's always that, like, high wire act. Mm-hmm. And then when it works, then the audience is extra grateful, like, oh, thank God. Oh, thank God. And that was that moment from the last summer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was even more to it than that. A couple of the Marvel execs were telling me later that this woman really pushed her way into watching it because she getting into the panel because it was full. And
yeah.
And she sat like right next to them. She sat on the floor because she couldn't. It was full. And they said when she was watching the footage, they just watched her and she was like shaking and crying and hugging them afterwards. And I think that this is the realization that there's once again that thing where there's a hunger for this type of of representation that I think has also hit something very alive in people.
Yeah.
And I felt that in that Hall H. It was pretty astounding, you know, that experience. It was probably my most memorable experience at Comic-Con. It was insane. It was amazing.
And Ryan Coogler, who it turns out is an incredibly nice guy.
Oh, he's amazing. He's so sweet.
But that type of... It's so interesting to see him do this kind of movie because he's a very intimate director.
Yes.
And, like, intimate storytelling. And then the scale of this movie is so grand.
Yes, yes. But he created from a place of intimate storytelling. He created from a place of really understanding the logic of this world and the specifics of, you know, who these people are as towards each other and who this, you know, what this world comprises and how it's the history of it and the tensions of the past and the tensions of the present day. So it was all very intimate, you know. And then around it is there's these epic elements that were just that he really figured out a great, you know, if you see him talking, him in the amazing set designer, the amazing Ruth Carter, who's the costume designer, you see how they talk about how they figured out all the components of this world and put them to life. It was very intimate understandings of how a people would work.
Yeah.
You know, so it actually came from that same place for him, which is, I think, why it was so cohesive and so absorbable so fast. When people see it, they kind of get a lot very quickly because it's like it was so rooted in something very intimately designed. It wasn't like, let's make something showy. No, it was like, let's make something really deeply connected to a very specific people. That was attractive to me, of course.
Did you have to audition for this? Because I feel like you could have been like, I'm probably a shoo-in. You're probably like, I know how to wield a weapon.
I would never think like that.
I know how to feel like I'm already trained more than most actors on how to do this stuff, you guys.
No. No, to answer your question, no, I wasn't thinking like that, but no, I did not audition. Now, what happened was Ryan had never watched The Walking Dead.
All right. There's still a few people out there that haven't seen.
His brother's a big fan, but he'd never watched it. He had watched me at Sundance, same year as Fruitvale came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a lot of panels and stuff with Michael B. And I never met Ryan, though. But I just loved him. I loved what he'd done, that he created this beautiful, amazing film right out of school. And I just love those types of stories. And he had seen me in a film that I was the lead in called Mother of George that same year. And that's when he said, I got to work with her. I mean, and then 5 years later, I get this, you have an offer for a Marvel movie? I was like, I have a what for a what? I was like, whatever. Like, I didn't believe them at all. Like, I thought, I totally, it was the night Eclipsed opened, I totally thought my manager was BS.
I mean, it is insane that you are two characters now that are a permanent fixture in... You will always have Michonne in your life, and you will always have Okoye in your life, because especially with the Disney stuff, that'll get infused at Disneyland, and there'll be all sorts of stuff, and it's like these two very powerful universes you've now been cemented in, and that's, as a fan, that is kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of amazed by it. I'm very thankful for it. You know, I'm very blessed by it. I just don't even, I tell you, I would never have thought of this for myself. Like, I would never have said, yeah, you know, when I start acting professionally, when I finish this MFA, I'm going to get to be, you know, I mean, I never would have imagined this is where I would have been allowed to come to.
But you never know where things are.
You really don't. And that's a real, like, when you put it, like, just how you put it, it's such a testament to that. But I mean, it's so exciting that I'm so excited for Black Panther in the sense that, you know, there's just so much about it that's just so universal, and I'm just so excited for people to see it, you know, and just sort of experience that. But I also think there's that component of it that, you know, I was just in Zimbabwe and South Africa like 2 weeks ago, and they are so excited for this movie. And that was really touching to go home and see that sort of excitement. And you realize, yeah, well, Africa's never had an epic story told on this scale. So that excitement, it makes so much sense. And I was at I have my little nonprofit. We have a playwrights conference. And I was sitting in one of the rooms watching a playwrights workshop. And two actresses got up. And one of them had the big... Captain America shield on her t-shirt, and the other one gets up and she has the just Marvel on her t-shirt with like four little Lego guys, you mm-hmm. know, like, you know, the Hulk and Iron Man and Thor, and I was just like, isn't this something? Like, I had never even thought about the fact that Marvel is big in my country. Like, I'd never even thought about
that. Well, it's big everywhere. I mean, it's just the idea too is that giving kids a character to look up to, role models to look up to, that are all just the same type of person mm-hmm. is really important. Like, kid, right. every kid deserves to know that they can, you know, do whatever they can dream that they want to do or aspire right. to yes. achieve yes. whatever
they want to achieve. Actually.
So, yeah, so where it, like, that, besides the fact that these movies are so fun, I really do believe that it's not frivolous. These movies really do have a very important cultural place. I mean,
they do.
You see what happened with Wonder Woman. And,
yes.
And
oh,
it's like,
gosh.
You know, like, that currency is very, very valuable because yes. it really does inspire kids in a world where, you know, if you spend a lot of time online, can be a very toxic and not a super forgiving place.
Yes, yes. We do definitely still need these epic heroic stories told and told from various perspectives. I think that's so real. And very, very true. And it's you don't even realize if you're acting in them the impact that they're having until, like, you know, the women, girls who've come up to me concerning Michonne, you know, and the things that they've told me that, you know, they garnered from her, or strength they garnered, or ways that they handled specific situations based on that. You realize how important representation is of showing various types of people doing various things. And at the same time, you know, it isn't even about, you know, it's people who don't look a thing like you who are telling you how
sure.
they were inspired by your character. So I think that's so beautiful. It's so beautiful about storytelling as a whole too. It totally can break barriers, especially if you storytell like courageously.
Yeah.
And not falling into like typical patterns, but really courageous storytelling, which I think totally is what we see a lot in Marvel storytelling, and what we see, I think, definitely in Black Panther, and what, you know, you see in The Walking Dead. And I've just been thankful to be a part of courageous storytelling.
You may not know the answer to this yet, because maybe some time has to pass, but being involved in this scale and this type of storytelling, has it affected your writing at all in the types of stories that you want to tell? Has it bled into that at all, or do you keep that pretty? Do you feel like you keep that pretty separate? And I don't mean so literally, like, I'm going to do a superhero play, but I just mean like the types of
we're going to fly in on a wire, you know, grab an audience member. That's funny. I think that's an interesting question. It's a very interesting question. You know, there are times where, like, when I think about The Walking Dead, people always say, do you want to write an episode of The Walking Dead? And I'm like, no, not really. Not really. I don't. I think the people writing it are the ones who should be writing it.
Yeah.
You know, and there, you know, there's a place. I have a place as an actor and a place as a writer. And sometimes I have a place as a writer. And that's where my primary place is. But I will definitely get into the beauty of what I do, of what I get to do with The Walking Dead, and what I got to do with Black Panther, was I could go and talk to the writer and challenge them even, you know, and have real deep conversations about, does this make sense? Okay, but what happened? And I don't know if, you know what I mean? You can have those conversations, and they're awesome artists, and so they're great to collaborate with, because mm-hmm. awesome artists always are. And I'm like, this is not the story I was meant to birth. So I never feel like I'm meant to be birthing it. But I know what my role is, to collaborate and to bring it to life through me as an actor. But I'm avoiding your question because I'm trying to think of
you
what
may not
the
know the answer to that yet.
You know what I mean? I was just talking to myself today about this. I think I do talk to myself a lot. I think the greatest stories that have been told in an epic way, even if they were about very ordinary people. mm-hmm. you think of Death of a Salesman, or you think of all of August Wilson's plays, or you know, you think of plays about very ordinary people, but the impact of how there's like August Wilson, I think, is the king of this. Like literally, he'll take these folks, black folks, poor in like you know the hood of Pittsburgh, and he finds a way. Those characters are epic. They are iconic, and they're taking you through the most grand arc of story you'll ever be taken through. And you were just sitting on a corner in Pittsburgh with them. You know, like, so to me, that's kind of the thing that I still pursue is like, how do I flip it? Mm-hmm. How do I make it so you're watching, you know, in like in the case of Eclipse, you're watching five chicks in a war zone. But, you know, when you're thinking these are statistics, I'm literally watching statistics. But by the end of the play, you weren't watching statistics. You can't forget those chicks, right. You know? And so that's kind of the thing I still kind of go for, I think. But watching what I have learned is I definitely am and want to start writing for the screen. And I think watching, I really do think that there has been a path that I've been on, not even entirely of my making, that involved a great apprenticeship coming from being on so many sets, but not having to helm the set.
Right.
So I've learned so much, and I'm feeling like I'm just about ready.
I mean, there's so many exciting things that you're going to do. Whenever the water level raises in one area, it just like everything else elevates. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to watch you as a creator. Because I think, you know, you have this amazing, you know, this incredible acting career that is just beginning to unfold. And at the same time, in parallel, this, you know, continuation of amazing writing career that's going to continue to unfold and evolve across different platforms. And it almost feels like you got to this point and you're just beginning now. Like, now you are starting. Do you feel that way, or do you feel like, oh my God.
I'm a little tired, though. Can I have like 2 weeks on a beach? No. I totally thank you. And I totally see what you're saying. I see what you mean. And there is, it's just interesting because, you know, I think back, I was looking at some pictures of me as a kid, like today, various reasons. And I was seeing all these pictures. I was like, oh my gosh, like it's, but you see the point. I see the point of every step of my life right now. I'm hitting a birthday next month. Okay.
Okay.
We need not say what that birthday is.
No, we don't have to.
We don't have to say 25. We don't have to. But you know, so there's a lot of reflection going on for me right now, but I see the purpose of everything I've been through thus far. And it feels like I'm building.
Are you excited about the reflection and the birthday, or are you not excited about the reflection and the birthday?
I am. I think, you know, I feel full grown, you know, and that's a good feeling.
It is.
I'm feeling full grown.
I freaked out about that birthday, and then it happened, and afterwards I was like...
Oh, 25? Yeah.
25, yeah. Uh-huh. Boy, it's a tough year. You're a quarter of a century. And after I had it, I was like, oh my God, I still don't know everything, but I don't feel as dumb. Like, I feel... like I know myself, I feel more comfortable with myself.
Right.
And that's not something that you can really, at least for, you know, I feel like a lot of young people spend a lot of time not being super comfortable because they're just trying to figure it out.
Right.
And then this is where you really start to figure it out and go, oh my God, I can feel comfortable in this skin that's on my body. And it feels good. But what I don't understand about your childhood is, were you born in Iowa and then moved to Zimbabwe, or was it the reverse, or what was your?
It is a reverse immigrant story. I guess most people don't have, which is that I was born in the Midwest in the United States.
Yeah.
And then I was raised in Zimbabwe.
Because your parents are African.
My parents are Zimbabwean, and they came here separately actually for college in the 60s. And they were buddies in high school, but they weren't together. Mm-hmm. And they both were, like, my mom was in college in Illinois, my dad was in college in Ohio, but then they had the same host family over Christmas.
Oh,
so then my dad made a move.
It worked.
Yeah, it was really blunt. My mom said he just like gave her a Christmas card that said "I love you" inside, and she was like, "Okay, four I guess we're here later. Now." Exactly. Little, do you know I have four, the other four of us?
I did know that.
Oh, okay. I was yeah. like, "Damn, that's good." But then, yeah. So then after that, they got married after college, and then moved to Penn State, where my dad was getting his PhD, and my mom was getting a couple master's degrees, and that's where they had my two elder siblings, and then. Iowa is because my dad went to a liberal arts school called Grinnell College. He's a professor of chemistry, and he became a tenured professor there, and that's where me and my just older sister were born.
And they moved back to Zimbabwe.
And then Zimbabwe gained independence in 1991. And when I was five, which was recent, but no. And then Zimbabwe gained independence, and then a lot of people were going back. And it was just this really exciting time. My middle name means is Jekesai, which means to illuminate. And it was really a time when I was born where they didn't know if like the war for independence would ever end and how it would end. And they were just kind of, it's kind of based on a hymn that's sort of saying, bring light to the dark circumstances we're in. And so very soon after I was born, the war did end. And I'm not saying I was the cause, but you know. No. and when I put it that way, I was like, what am I trying to say? No. The war did end, and then a lot of people started to go back and invest in the new Zimbabwe. And so a lot of the kids I grew up around were born in like Australia or Canada or England or the States, and their parents had been there in the 60s getting education and living their lives, and then they came back to Zimbabwe to help build this new nation. So that's really hopeful and beautiful.
Now, I didn't want to skate over this, but I'm almost positive that about a half hour ago you said you were talking about something, and you said my clown professor.
Clown teacher, yeah.
Your clown
in
teacher.
Grad school. You've never heard of clown class? You should know about clown class.
I imagine if you're studying theater, there is some, because you have to understand your body, right? Your physical body. And
clown class is a whole thing. Like there is a study in clown class. Like there is a study of clown technique. It's a real thing.
Okay, what is it?
I don't know. I can't remember. I went to grad school a long time ago. But what I do remember
25, well, like a year ago,
I know,
right?
25. I know. I just finished last week. But the whole thing with clown class, it's amazing. It was one of my very favorite components of education, like in my entire life. It really teaches you to find this place. You find your clown ultimately at the end of clown class. You should totally do this.
I probably will.
You've got to find this teacher called Chris Bays. He's amazing. And you find your clown, and you don't know who your clown's going to be. It's not hypnosis, okay? But it's kind of like you go to this place that's really unhinged, and you kind of don't know who's going to come out, and you sort of, there are all these ways that he sort of helps you open up this part of yourself that really gets kind of hampered down in the stresses of life. And it's kind of that place, it's almost like that kid place, it's almost like your child place,
right?
But like that's why every single clown like person you every single person who plays clowns that you'll meet, they have kind of a different type of clown. There's the sort of conventional idea of a clown, but like the real clowns, they are different. They're very, very different because you've had to find your clown personality, and it's a process.
Yep.
And once you find them, you're like, what was that? Who was that that just came out of me? That voice, that person, what they were saying? Like, I have no idea what just came out of me. It's really kind of cool. But the one thing he said that was also really awesome was just talking about how you, like the spirit of what you bring to something. And he said, if the spirit is right, we forgive all the mistakes. And there was just something about that has led me through my career, like how I absorb what I'm watching or what I'm considering being a part of. Like what I saw when I watched The Walking Dead, I was like, the spirit of this is just so right. And like, that's of course what I feel like when I look at when I looked at Ryan Coogler's work, you know what I mean? But like, there's a spirit of a thing that, I learned from clown class. You've got to take a clown class.
I would happily take a clown class.
It's amazing. I need to take one again, actually. And then, in grad school now, Chris Bays was also stolen by Yale.
Yale!
I know! They stole all our teachers, whatever. They do a clown show every year. And it's a part of a season of student productions. And there's a clown show is the coolest thing.
I would bet that if I went through that class, I would probably discover I am completely different than what I thought. Because so much of what you put out in the world, a lot of the time, can be based on, you know, baggage and defenses and insecurity right. and the type of thing you want to project right. and the type of thing. You
right.
know, so much about trying to control the external world.
Right.
So what happens when you strip all that away and you really just are who you are, which can be a very scary thing to even...
Exactly. To venture into. Yeah. You have to feel safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you do. You do. I mean, like I was in, with classmates that I was with, oh my God, 12 hours a day for 3 years. So, you know, I felt safe by then. And I think, well, yeah, it was a third year class. And, you know, of course, the teacher, he has to gain your trust as well.
Sure.
Because he's kind of taking you on a journey. But yes. It's so cool. You've got to find your clown.
I have to gain the trust of a pack of clowns.
Exactly.
Maybe get the
and
clown
then
pack.
You've got to record it.
That could be really interesting. Actually, I mean, I wonder if he'd probably be a really interesting podcast guest to just sort
yeah.
of talk about Chris Bayes.
No, yeah, Chris Bayes. If Chris Bayes can get you to your clown and then interview your clown.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, because that's what he does. He starts to talk to your clown and sort of bring out this different thing that's inside of you.
Is that different thing like a million handkerchiefs that never stop coming out?
No, that's the conventional stuff. This okay. is the real clown
this
stuff.
Is the
I'm talking
real
about real clown.
Shit.
Yeah.
This is real clown
that's
shit.
That's kind of the expected thing about clown. This is the real stuff. I mean, I learned so much from that class as an artist, like just that place sometimes you have to go to. And I found like a little film I did years ago. I found my entire character through finding her, like finding my clown. Like it was like unhinging in her circumstances. Oh, there she is, you know?
I wonder, I kind of think of things in terms of this way. Like, I think the clown that I put out in the world is sort of like Batman TV series Joker, but maybe my real clown is like Heath Ledger Joker.
Oh,
whereas,
no,
like, you
no,
think
no,
it's really
no.
goofy? No.
He's not going to be like that.
Okay, I hope not.
I think he'll probably be like a crier.
I am very emotional. This is why I cannot, this is why it's difficult for me to watch drama.
Oh, really?
Because when I watch drama, I absorb it so hard that it's hard for me to shake after a couple of days. Like, I'm basically just like an empathic sponge.
That's great, though.
And so it's hard.
Do you watch plays much?
No, I don't. And I think that probably has a lot to do with, you know, just having like a very difficult attention span.
Oh, come on.
My attention span sucks. I get really fidgety. I get really... Yeah.
No. If you're watching a good play, you're not going to worry about your attention span.
I guess that's true. But not every play.
I'll take you to some plays.
Would you please take me to some plays?
Yes, but you got to come out to New York too.
I will come out to New York.
Okay.
And then you got to come back here because it turns out we're almost kind of neighbors.
I know. I live just down the hill, you know, the common folk. But I live... I think I could see your plays if I look, like if I turn my head all the way up from my
up at Kesselhurstwick. Yes.
I love your plays. That's
amazing. Thank you.
You have to take me on a tour. I got to look at all this.
Yeah, I'll take you on a tour. We've completed the podcast, and I have to say, I said this to you the other night when I was leaving, when I said to you and Coleman, I said, I adore you.
Oh,
I don't mean
you.
That lightly. I mean it very sincerely. I am
thank
so
you,
glad that we've gotten to become friends over this very bizarre
I
journey
know.
That not a lot of people get to have.
I know.
And it is one of the things that makes me happiest about what I do is like, oh, I just get to meet people that I really like, and everyone's really sweet, and we're all kind of... You know, and we're all in kind of in tandem in our own little rowboats, just, you know, like going along.
Right,
and,
right. But supporting each other.
But supporting each
which
other.
Which is awesome.
And I appreciate that. So please have an amazing time. I know the premiere is, but when we're recording this, the premiere is Monday for Black Panther. I will be there.
Yes.
And I will wave to you from afar because you're definitely going to be swamped by
no,
by
no. You got to come and do your dance again.
I don't
the
know
night,
if I can do
the night
dance.
Will not be complete.
Can I tell you what the thing about the dance is, when they were playing Yacht Rock, I was overtaken by the dance, but then we went to that other party
right.
where they were playing like really legitimately cool music
right.
and I did not know how to maneuver my body. Like I can dance
well,
to like,
you know,
Boz Scaggs and the Doobie Brothers.
Well, there was this very interesting moment though where you said you were leaving, and then I don't know what we said, the band is breaking up or something, and then you seemed to get quite sad about that, and then you took off your jacket and started to dance.
I didn't want to leave. I felt like, you know, because, you know, I expected I was going to go, yeah, I want to go, and I thought you guys were going to be like, alright, have a great fuck off, have a great night, and then you were like, no, don't leave. And I was like, oh, I gotta stay. And in the back of my head, I go, your ears are gonna ring for like 3 weeks. And I go, I know, but when do I get to hang out with Danai? When do I get to hang out with Coleman? Everyone's so busy, you know? Like,
know.
So this is a... You like I had fun at
it
stuff
so
that I don't
fun.
Normally have fun at.
I know.
Like,
I had
of
a
loud
lot of
alcohol fueled parties.
Right. It's true. It's just about being around the right people. And that actually, those two parties were really cool.
Yeah.
They were cool parties. Like, there were parties where people were just there to hang and dance and enjoy really good music and say hey to each other and show each other love. So that those are, like, the right types of parties. Because a lot of times I go into a place, I'm like there was a place we were, like, okay.
I don't know about this one.
And, yeah, you know what I mean? So there are different types of places, but we found some really good places. So that was a really fun night.
It
so
really
thank
was.
You.
Thank
the,
you.
The one of the definite highlights was your dance machine moment.
Thank you. I will dance machine again.
Awesome.
We'll figure it out. But until then, enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end. Oh, I should say Walking Dead. Well, Walking Dead comes back February 25th. Black Panther, well, the premiere is Monday. What date is Black Panther?
16th.
February 16th.
Yeah.
February 16th, Black Panther.
Yes.
And then February 25th, Walking Dead.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a very busy winter / spring for Danai. And we will see. Yeah, well, I'll see you through all that. And then also, I always feel like, as many times as I've said it, I still feel like I never say Danai properly.
That's all right. Listen, the old people, it was amazing when I was in Zim, and I'd hear it said properly all the time. And I was with my friend who's in my play, The Eclipse. I just, impulsively, I said, "You're coming with me." It was like the day before I left. And so she came, and she was like, "Wow, I've never heard your name like this." Like, it was like, your name is being said in this way. I was like, this is how you say it. But like, come on. You try really hard. You're one of the best. You're one of the best in the West. You're one of the best in the West.
But I've... Wait, there's an East Coast good one?
No, I mean in the West.
Oh,
like,
the West
the
of the
West
world.
The West of the world.
I'll take Western Hemisphere.
You're one of the best. You and Andy Lincoln. Very, very good at it.
I will take Western Hemisphere.
Yes.
All right. Excellent.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.